Hello, this is Mark Shanton, welcoming you to the first of Theatre Voice's regular critical roundups for 2011. Charles Spencer of the Daily Telegraph, Matt Wolfe of the International Herald Tribune, and David Benedict of Variety join me to discuss three new plays, a world premiere of a play written in 1942, and a new production of Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. Let's begin with the Shakespeare, which marks the return of Sir Peter Hall to the National Theatre that he ran for a decade and a half, from 1973 to 1988, in a production that stars his daughter Rebecca as Viola. David, let's start with you. Peter Hall has, of course, a long tradition with Shakespeare. He founded the RSC, he ran the National for all this time, and he keeps coming back to it. He's done this play, I think, four or five times. How did this one fit into the pantheon?
I wish we could just pass over this, because I think it's pretty lamentable, and given that the man is 80 with the remarkable career that he has had, it would be nice just to remain silent about it. But I do think that this is incredibly weak work. It's a very, very sentimental production. It's half an hour longer, literally half an hour longer than the last West End production, which Michael Grandage directed. It's even longer than the Sam Mendes one at the Donmar, which was fairly funereally paced. It's largely long because it has no drive. It's as if Peter Hall has rehearsed and gone over with the cast what every line means. So it's very clear, it's very lucid, but it has no energy because people aren't really acting with each other. There's no sense of the individual households. You just get this very autumnal, rather nicely lit, faintly soporific production in which the stakes remain incredibly low. There are individually good performances. Charlie Edwards is the best Aggie Cheek I've ever seen and is the standout of the show. But when Aggie Cheek is the best thing in the show, you know you're in trouble. Viola, Rebecca Hall, I've seen her on stage before. I've always thought she was rather good. Here, I felt she was completely under-energized. Nobody's acting on the line. They pause in the middle of a line as if waiting for a close-up. And as a result, the play drips along.
Indeed. I mean, one of my fears watching it myself was that these actors have been left to get on with it. I mean, there wasn't any sense of them being directed. Simon Callow turning in his regulation, going red in the face, acting out of the side of his mouth performance. Matt?
I'm not sure you can really direct Simon Callow these days, so I wouldn't hold him up as an exemplar of much. I don't know. I mean, it seems to me, in a way, Twelfth Night, possibly any Shakespeare play, but Twelfth Night is such a Rorschach test for the director that's doing it, because it's so many different plays rolled into one. I've seen Twelfth Nights that were incredibly moving and rather sad, Twelfth Nights that were joyous and buoyant. I mean, the Grandage one had a spring in its step, but that's because Grandage is at this point in his career where he has a spring in his step. Peter Hall, you know, has had a remarkable life, but he is an old man by his own admission. And so this is, as David rightly says, it's an autumnal production to match the rather wintry As You Like It that he did a couple of years ago with Rebecca as well. I really liked the first act of this a lot. I thought Rebecca's entrance was absolutely luminous, moist, dewy, open to experience. But I think the lack of energy does take its toll in the second act. However, I was very, very moved by Feste at the end, who I think Sir Peter presents as a vision of him. And Feste is played as an old man with sort of scraggly hair, and when at the very end he says, "We'll strive to please you every day," I think that's Peter Hall saying, "That's what I've tried to do for 80 years, and I hope I've succeeded."
That was David Ryle, of course, who's a long-standing member of the Peter Hall company, the extended Peter Hall company. Charlie, I think you liked this more than...
Yes, I did. It's unashamedly old-fashioned. You're not going to expect Sir Peter Hall to sort of reinvent the wheel. He's absolutely steeped in Shakespeare and basically describes himself as an iambic fundamentalist, and he just wants to deliver the text. I don't think he's even that interested in interpretation. He just wants to make the play itself as clear and lucid as possible. And on that level, I think it worked. But I did think that it could have been funnier and deeper at times. I think I was kind. I gave it 4 stars. I think it's more like a 3-star production. I just couldn't bear to give him 3 stars at what might be his last show. I thought Rebecca Hall was terrific. As you said, Andrew Aguecheek, terrific. And I just think and I did find that autumnal feeling about it was very moving. It was an event as much as a, you know, and I can't see that he'll be doing a lot more Shakespeare in future.
He's supposed to be doing Henry the Fourth parts 1 and 2 at Bath this summer.
Yes, well, it'd be interesting to see. But I agree. What's needed is perhaps an assistant director to put a bit more welly in.
Well, there is. There is an associate director who's on the case, because I'm told that he only rehearses half a day, and then the others have to come in.
But I did think, I mean, if you want to hear Shakespeare, you know, well spoken, I thought it was very good. You disagree?
Well, you see, I have never quite understood what this means. Shakespeare well spoken. They're plays. They're dramas. Of course, they should be spoken clearly. You expect that whether you're doing Rattigan, Shakespeare, Pinter, or Jez Butterworth. But the point is that you compare this, maybe comparisons are odious, but you compare this with Lear at the Donmar, another small-scale production. There, the cast also speak very well, but you never get the sense that they're speaking, because what they're doing is acting with each other. This looks like they've examined the text and they're doing it for radio. There's never a sense of what the stakes are, what I'm going to get from making, what I, as perhaps Viola, gets from making love to Orsino. They just say the lines to each other. Well spoken is not enough. You actually have to invest this with meaning, with a sense of what you need to get, what you want to achieve, and what you're getting across to the audience. And then as a director, you have to decide which of those lines at any given point, which of those through lines at any given point, you're pushing towards a meaning of something. It's not enough to go, oh, well, the play is so marvellous that all these ideas about sexuality or the hierarchy of the house or how love overcomes grief will somehow rise up. If you just put the ingredients in a pot, mysteriously all these flavours will come up. No, it's not a
simple. Well, I think they're meant to perceive it also. I mean, it reminds me, the old days, they used to talk about hearing a play, didn't they, rather than seeing a play. And I think Hall's productions are a bit like that now. You hear the play very well, but it does need a bit more.
But there are scenes where people are just literally standing around in a semicircle. You know, this has not been animated to any degree. Has he looked at the stage?
And there certainly isn't much to look at. I mean, that's design-wise, it's been very stripped back. And
I actually rather like the design, because it's this sort of billowing sheet that comes floating to the stage and creates the stage floor, and it is itself autumnal, and it's got an image of sort of seared leaves in it. And it's designed by Anthony Ward, who, funnily enough, designed the Sam Mendes production all those years ago. But one thing about it, by the way, if you really want to get a measure of where Sir Peter Hall is at now, and I recommend this to listeners and to anyone, is go on the National Theatre website and watch the interview that Nick Heitner did with him about this production. It is incredibly moving, and you really see that he's an old man, and that you see where this production came from.
Yes.
And he says at the beginning of the interview, "I didn't get it right, but I still keep going. I'm still here."
From Peter Hall to his son Edward, who is now running Hampstead Theatre, a venue that specialises in new writing, as his father did too earlier in his career, premiering plays by Beckett and Pinter, amongst others. Edward has brought Nina Raine, who wrote one of last year's best new plays, Tribes, at the Royal Court, to now write and direct Tiger Country, a play set in a hospital operating theatre. Matt, Tribes was one of my absolutely favourite plays of last year. A tough act to follow, I think. How do you think Tribes?
Yes, I like Tribes very much as well. Well, you know, I enjoyed this, and it seems almost sort of a contradiction in terms to say that I enjoyed a play at the Hampstead Theatre, because that's been so rarely the case of late. But maybe they're on a new role with a new artistic director at Hall. I wasn't sure at the beginning, to be honest, because it seemed so familiar. It seemed like, why is this on stage? You could see this on television for free. Why did we schlep across to NW6 to watch it? But then it sort of takes hold, and actually, as somebody who myself was in hospital last year, and I went with a friend who has had all sorts of experiences of hospital over the last couple of years, it begins to kind of take hold in a rather transfixing way. I also think she's a very good director of her own work, which isn't always the case. I think she does a very, very good job. There were some moments where, we might talk about this in relation to Greenland, where there were all these people kind of bustling around the stage, I thought, to not much purpose. But then when she isolates out the individual narratives, it really begins to sting.
Yeah, it's interesting. Nina Raine did direct her own first play, Rabbit, and then the second one, Tribes of Roger Michelle. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Funny you should mention being in hospital recently. I, too, was in hospital just before Christmas with a major back surgery, and so therefore this was very uncomfortable to watch. It felt very close to home, and in fact, at, even if you haven't been in hospital recently, there's incredibly uncomfortable scenes, like the projections are all around, including the one of the wasted testicle. We're watching the surgery on that. Grim stuff, David.
Oh, I didn't find it grim at all. I mean, like I'm sure everybody else has been in and out of hospitals at various points in my life. I could attest that I also did find it extraordinarily authentic, and it gets. They've even put disinfectant into the theatre at the beginning, so it smells right. I do think it's a startlingly good piece of design in terms of the lighting, Fergus O'Hare's sound design, Rick Fisher's lighting. You get a complete sense. Lizzie Clacken, the stage designer, whose work I have massively disliked in the past, I thought did a terrific job of opening up the Hampstead Theatre space, so the audience is on two sides. It's this great big open space with nurses' stations at either end, and as you say, there's hustle and bustle rushing through, and Rain knows exactly how to isolate a moment. She's also incredibly good, and we saw this in Tribes and also in Rabbit, she's incredibly good at cutting. She knows exactly, like a surgeon in this case, where to start a scene. You don't get sort of 5 minutes of preamble and setting up who's who and what's what. It's like watching Aaron Sorkin's work on The West Wing. A scene starts and you don't quite know where you are, and you're fighting to catch up, and then about a minute into the scene you go, oh yes, I know, here we are. And that really engages you with the text, and I think it's a really impressive piece of work. In the end, it's not her finest play, and there's a reason why. You know, it was developed over a couple of years at the Royal Court, and the Royal Court eventually passed on it. It actually predates Tribes. Tribes is a more mature play, but I do think it's a really impressive piece of work.
And great that they're actually putting it on after all.
Yes, I'm glad it went on. It struck me as very much a disappointment in comparison with Tribes, and I also knew that it was done before, and it did feel slightly to me as though, you know, a play that might have remained in the bottom of the drawer had been sort of directed up to the max and done quite well. But actually, as a play, did it tell you anything new? Were there any characters that you really came to care about in any detail? I don't think you did. I don't think it. I would say it was inferior to a good TV hospital drama, because I think the storylines were quite slight, and not unpredictable. I mean, something like, you know, the doctor who gets cancer himself. I mean, that was terribly underplayed. It was startlingly well directed by her. I mean, she really got the most out of it, and so typical of the previous regime of Hampstead that they've never opened up that space. I mean, we never dreamed that it could be an epic theatre like that.
The RSC season.
Yeah.
That's true, yes.
Yeah, but it's a perfectly, you know, it shows off the theatre to fine effect, and it's got some very good acting, but it didn't seem to me to add up to a satisfying whole.
I don't think it doesn't do what you sort of want it to do and what the first act keeps threatening to do, which is you go, ah, this is the story of Tusita Jayasundara, who is going to be the doctor who's struggling for promotion, and because she's Asian, because she's a woman, it's going to be her play. No, it's not. Is it going to be Adam James as the doctor who is dealing with possible cancer? Is it his play? Actually, what it's doing is making you look at doctors, plural, but in a way that most medicated soaps on TV, like Doctors, or indeed ER, or you know, Casualty, the world's longest running medicated soap, they never really do that, because they're too busy pursuing the sentimental emotional line. This is about the pressures on doctors.
Yeah, but we know about all that. I mean, it didn't seem to me to be saying anything new about, you know, doctors are overworked and that they have to become harder if they're to survive. And it just seemed to me to be a lot of truisms.
But I did think it was interesting to sort of be in a room watching people having to make those kind of decisions on too little sleep, and making you understand that actually you and I can make mistakes in our lives and nothing really happens. If they make mistakes, people die.
But isn't that blindingly obvious? I mean, yes, isn't telling you anything new?
Well, I know, Charlie, but you could always say there are only four plots in the world.
No, but
right?
I just feel that I just didn't ever really become fully engaged with any of the characters because the characterisation was so thin.
I'll tell you one thing I liked about this play, though, again, possibly by contrast with Greenland, was that it didn't pretend to be the state of the nation play about medicine and the NHS. It wasn't David Hare, add on to the David Hare trilogy. We will tell you where medicine is in 2011. It gave you a potpourri of characters. It didn't actually tell you that much about any of them, but it told you enough, and you know, it was satisfying on that level. Well, as Beckett said, it would have passed anyway.
At the Almeida, which has become an unofficial home for the plays of Neil LaBute, there's the British premiere of Becky Shaw, an off-Broadway play by a LaBute-like writer, Gina Gianfrido, which revolves around another dysfunctional family perpetuating cycles of damage on each other. Charlie, I know I'm in a terrible minority on this. I came out of this loathing this play and every character in it, and then I opened the reviews the next day, including yours, who seemed to love it.
I think it's an absolute cracker, this play, and also I don't think it could be anything less like Neil LaBute, because it's subtle and it's got heart and wit, and it's not just all tailed to a sort of zinging twist in the tail at the end like LaBute's plays. I mean, I think it's a deep play. It's called Becky Shaw, and I'm sure that is a reference to Becky Sharp, because it's about a manipulative woman who may be a victim or maybe something worse than that, and it's about sexual relationships, and there's a kind of Jane Austen-ish quality to its wit, in that it uses romantic relationships to explore the morality of the characters in a very interesting way, and using them as a litmus test. But above all, it's just wonderfully funny, I think, and also quite moving. I mean, is this Becky Shaw? Is she an out-and-out victim, or is she just out to get what she can to work her way up in the world and get a rich husband? There's this fascinating, almost incestuous relationship between a man and a woman who've been brought up together as brother and sister, but who clearly have a strong attraction between them, and a wonderful old harridan of a mother. And above all this, the brother in this is a sort of great anti-hero of our times, in that he's completely politically incorrect, he can't stand anything to do with sentiment, or a ruthless operator in big business. And by the end, I'd begun to find him, because he's so honest, easily the most sympathetic character in the play. I think it's a fascinating piece of work, and actually, in a healthier West End, I think it would transfer there.
That character, in fact, is played by the guy who originated the role in New York.
And in Louisville, Kentucky, where the play was first seen. I saw this play in New York 2 years ago, off-Broadway at Second Stage, when it was at an early preview, and I really disliked it. And I, with David Wilson Morris, and then I saw it here at the Almeida, and I absolutely adored it. And it's interesting how the same play, but with a different cast aside from one actor, can be completely transformed and across the Atlantic. The big difference to me between the New York and London productions is that the London production is very moving and the New York production wasn't moving at all. I think it's essentially a dissection of damage across these various characters, but with an amazing amount of humor and wit, some of it very politically incorrect. But it has a beating heart, which makes Max the kind of scabrous truth teller, in a way, the genuine hero of the piece. And you can see why he was brought into the family, because he and the mother played brilliantly in a two-scene part by Hayden Gwynn, who seems to be graduating into Elaine Stritch. She played Elaine Stritch's part in Company in concert last October, singing Ladies Who Lunch, and this is a role you could imagine a younger Elaine Stritch batting out of the park, but she does it brilliantly. But there's something between the mother and this quasi-adoptive son, who isn't really, he was bought into the family, where they speak the same language. I think it's a very moving play, and the more I think about it, the more, it's very open-ended. That's one thing about it I love. Most American plays these days tie themselves up in neat little knots. This doesn't. You don't really know where it's going to go, which I love.
No, you're just, at the end, it doesn't really give it away. No. I mean, you've just got
She walks towards him.
She walks towards him. You've got two characters who loathe each other, staring at each other, who might well end up going to bed together. Fantastic.
And you say two characters loathing, and I just watched the play loathing every minute, because I just hated everybody in it.
I think you were just in a funny mood and your back was hurting, because it's so well written.
I mean, I of course want to take issue with the idea that just because you don't like the characters in a play that you would find that a bad play, but that may be a discussion for another time. I'm going to be Captain Cold Water, though, because I didn't dislike it nearly as much as you, Mark, but it didn't move me, and it felt American in the sense that there's a lot of not first-rate American writing, I'm talking about the second-rate American writing, which is incredibly polished surface, which is partly to do with the American playwriting system and the fact that there's so little subsidy, very few plays get put on without being workshopped to death. And the problem with being workshopped to death is that everything gets polished. And this has immense amount of polish. It has great one-liners. And it has those kinds of pleasures, which I was enjoying. But I felt that that there was much less subtext than the playwright wanted you to believe there was. The oddest thing for me was that for some strange reason, because I decided to do no preparation on it, I just wanted to see the play like a punter would see it, I'd got it into my head that it was written by a man, so I spent the whole of the play going, this is a really interesting play for a man to have written, and then discovered it was written by a woman, at which point I then thought, actually, it's also quite an interesting play for a woman to have written, because, like you say, Matt, I think that the most interesting character is the one played by David Wilson Barnes, who, yes, is non-PC, rejects anything that is emotionally invasive, wants to keep the whole of his life at arm's length. And he's brilliantly played by Wilson Barnes. And the fact that he becomes the most sympathetic character is very, very interesting.
And he says out loud that he wishes the title character had, in fact, killed herself. Wouldn't that have been nice? In her face.
And actually, I think that the title character is the wrong character. Nothing to do with Daisy Haggard's lovely performance. Very, very underrated actor, Daisy Haggard. Best thing in episodes. I think that the play shouldn't be called... I think it gives the play the wrong steer to call it Becky Shaw, and that I can see the argument that you made, Charlie, but it doesn't for me, it just didn't hold up because it doesn't have the emotional undertow to make that work.
Except she's the catalyst to how everyone else reacts.
I mean, you are right.
She's the one who provokes them into
their... You're right, David. A lot of commentators, this wasn't the play called Max, and I do think David Wilson Barnes is giving one of those performances where you think, what's he going to do next? Because he's so perfect for this.
He is like Spacey in that
Kevin
he doesn't...
Kevin Spacey-ish sort of... Even he's even got the forehead.
Yeah,
and
but also, but he's got that other,
and
but he doesn't. He doesn't have that really annoying thing that Kevin Spacey does. What he does is not to anticipate. You do not know what he's going to do. He doesn't indicate that he's about to cry or he's about to get cross or he's about to rush over. Everything happens absolutely on the beat that it's supposed to happen. So you watch him like a hawk. Yeah. Spacey does that, but just lets you know he's about to do it, which makes him terribly
watchable.
It's
more indicating.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, I think, about Becky Shaw, the character, and I have to... Daisy Haggard is just wonderful. If you'd seen The Woman in New York, there's no comparison. She's sort of toothsome in a way that makes you warm to her, but there's also something a bit off-putting about her, and you can't place her, which is perfect for the part. And so much about her is stuff that's reported to us which we don't see, which makes her very, to me, very puzzling. You know, what has happened that she and her family don't speak to each other? We really never get absolutely to the bottom
of it.
And
why did both black boyfriends leave?
Yes.
So
and
cruel.
Why is it that she, of all people, would go on a date and they'd be mugged at gunpoint? That doesn't usually happen on a date. So what is it that she tends to attract?
Well, she's an accident waiting to happen, isn't she?
Yes,
she's
yes.
one of those sort of awful, awful people.
And the relationship that should take place, which is between Susanna Lovely, Anna Madeley, and Max, they're not, as the Almeida website wrongly put it for a while, I hope they've corrected it, they're not step-siblings. It's important that they're not step-siblings because you have to believe something could happen between them. But, of course, they resist it because of these rather complex family machinations. I think it's a fascinating play, but this is the best production of it I can imagine it getting.
I feel I ought to see it again now, so thank you.
Yes, write 20 lines. I got it wrong.
A play I don't want to see again. After last year's earthquakes in London, the National returns to the theme of climate change, this time in a group written play called Greenland, co-authored by four younger writers, Maura Buffini, Matt Charman, Penelope Skinner and Jack Thorne, directed by Bijan Chobani. David, comparisons with Earthquakes in London?
I never liked Earthquakes in London, I'm afraid to say, because I thought that you went into the theatre going, the planet's going to hell in a handbasket, and at the end you went, the planet's going to hell in a handbasket. Great, that was 3 hours of my life.
And
beautifully staged.
And here's another two.
And here's another two. This is... The odd thing about this is that at the end of it, I felt a degree of goodwill towards it that I couldn't explain because it wasn't repaying my concentration. This is four writers and Ben Power, a dramaturg who interestingly has worked a lot with Headlong and Rupert Gould. He has, presumably, he and Bijan Chobani, the director, have knitted together four scenarios that were provided by the four different writers It is impossible to know who did what and who is responsible for what. And there are flashes of interest, but the problem is that these are four small scenarios that might work as a Bush play, but they're blown up into this 2-hour intervalless piece that tells us nothing much new. And it's done on a wide open, stripped out stage that literally and metaphorically leaves everybody and every idea stranded, because you're just left in this huge space with, oh no, you know, actors doing terrible things like being required to conjure up a rave from absolutely nowhere for about 20 seconds, and you go, this is toe-curlingly embarrassing, please stop.
Or the poor character that has to be suspended a supermarket trolley the whole show.
You go, can we start a list of things you should not be allowed to do on a stage, and that is use a supermarket trolley as an image of consumerism. Just stop now.
I mean, I didn't fear that the whole play felt like it was a stitched together version of four separate plays they'd all been writing on climate change. And, oh, somehow we've got four writers who've all written separate plays. Let's put them together in one room. It felt like a disaster to me, Charlie.
Oh, it was bloody awful. I mean, it really was. And none of the stories came to life at all. I mean, there was no characterisation. I thought it was absolutely significant that the programme didn't actually bother to name who was playing which characters, because they didn't really exist.
Probably, you would have gone to rest before they knew what they were doing.
And, you know, there ought to have been a poignant moment where this, you know, the daughter of, you know, an earnest lower middle class couple was meant to be studying to become a teacher and ran off and joined the, you know, the hardline environmentalists, but didn't have any emotion at all, not least because, as you say, she spent most of her time in a bloody supermarket trolley suspended from the fly. And the other thing I really objected to about this play is basically there was very little attempt at drama, and basically it was just telling us a lot of facts, or possibly facts, about, you know, we are all doomed, and that's all it said over and over again. We are all doomed unless we change our ways. It didn't enter a single note of scepticism about whether, you know, climate change is necessarily caused by man, and it was just right on crap.
We have a Richard Beam play coming up to the soon, The Heretic, which may offer the contrary view. But there was a lovely polar bear.
Polar bear.
I would have cut the polar bear there, because you go, this is entirely wrong. This is not speaking really to any of the themes. It's just providing cheap laughs.
It's just cute.
Yeah.
Yeah, but at least it's cute. Yeah.
But
Come Fly With Me sequence?
Well, I was going to say, since we're not going to get Twilight Arts musical in London, we now have a little soupçon of it here.
Although it is playing in Vegas.
Well, that's good. Next best place. I don't know, sort of in a funny way, to echo David, I felt sort of a strange amount of goodwill towards this at the end, because it wasn't sort of malign. There was something about earthquakes in London that to me seemed much more smug. This seemed full of good intentions gone ludicrously awry. And at the end, when all these papers sort of fall on the audience, I was gathering them all up to see what they were, and it was hilarious. Some of it is the script of Time and the Conways. Some of it is the script of Hamlet. Some of it is the script of the play we just saw. And then I'll offer £5 to anyone who can figure out what play this is from. It's somebody with Gary, Where Is the Teacher's Cane? So that was interesting. And it was also interesting listening to people scrunching their plastic water bottles during it while we're watching a show about how we shouldn't be drinking out of plastic bottles.
And 15 million plastic bottles, apparently, per day.
But the most embarrassing was afterwards the talkie-okie.
In
the foyer, where this rather attractive-looking guy snares hapless people from the audience and sits them down and engages them in impromptu debate. Oh. And this is going to go on every performance throughout the run.
Excruciating. Finally, this year marks the centenary of the birth of playwright Terence Rattigan, soon to be celebrated by starry West End productions of his plays Flare Path, directed by Trevor Nunn, and Cause Célèbre, directed by Thea Sharrock, who recently directed After the Dance of the National. There's also a production of The Deep Blue Sea at the West Yorkshire Playhouse in Leeds. But the centenary has begun with a real curiosity from a small fringe studio basement, German Street Theatre, who are offering the world stage premiere of the original version of his 1944 play, Less Than Kind. Really odd to find a Rattigan premiere at this stage, isn't it, John?
It is, though I'm not quite sure how much of a premiere it is. And there's a lot of talk about how Less Than Kind was transformed and diluted into Love and Idleness by the Lunts, who originally starred in it. And that originally it was Rattigan coming out as not the frivolous entertainer that he was taken from, that this was his big support for, you know, for the new order that would exist at the end of the war. In fact, the character, the son of Sarah Crowe, who is having an affair with a government minister, is the one, and a very right wing government minister, who puts all the sort of socialist arguments, is a prig from the start, who no one could possibly take seriously in his views. He's only 17, he's particularly callow. And I don't think that the biographer Michael Barlow has sort of said that this was a serious play that was completely undermined. I'm not sure that that's the case. On the other hand, it's a really enjoyable evening, I think, and it's done with terrific style and great economy at the German Street Theatre. I mean, one of the most comfortable of London fringe theatres, and they've got no money, but they make it work. And I think it's a really nice play. And Sarah Crowe as this woman who's having an affair with Michael Simpkins as this very sort of tough, hardline Tory politician who just wants to make money. She's never been better, I don't think. I found her very touching. And the boy, whose name I can't remember, I'm afraid, but he too is very, very nicely played. And he's got all the humanity of Rattigan. He's not in the same league as the Deep Blue Sea or the Browning version, but it's getting there. And lovely evocation of period and straitened times.
Yeah, and Sarah Crowe's going straight on to the RSC, and what I think is rather marvellous is actors like Sarah Crowe and indeed Michael Simpkins, who don't exactly slum it, but they go to the fringe all the time. It's rather inspiring. But what about the Rattigan revival, as it were? Suddenly, we're all taking him very seriously.
I think we absolutely should take Rattigan seriously. He made a rod for his own back later in life, by the time the 50s arrived, at a point at which his writing begins to get thinner, the court revolution happens, and Rattigan issues a lot of public statements being dismissive of that work, which was really foolish, and he put critics' backs up, and didn't write another good play until Separate Tables, and then Cause Célèbre, which opened shortly before he died. But he's a great, great writer. The Browning version, Deep Blue Sea, Separate Tables, and even Tiny Little Bits of Less Than Kind, you suddenly notice, God, he's good. The problem is that you look at him now, it's very difficult to watch him because the second half of the 20th century is devoted to drama, which is explicit. It's about people, you know, they're called angry young men for a good reason, because they are young, so they've got a lot of opinions. Most of them are angry, and most of them were from men. It's all about what you say, and Rattigan is all about what you don't say and what you cannot say, in his case because of his sexuality. And in the mid-50s, 2,500 people a year were being arrested for homosexual offences, and the Lord Chamberlain's office wouldn't let you put gay characters on the stage. Nicholas de Jong famously attacked Rattigan in his book about censorship and said that Rattigan should have been much more out, and you just kind of go, well, nobody else was. It's not as if he's the one hiding in the closet and everybody else is pushing against the door. You couldn't do it. This play has got almost none of that. It's much lighter, it's much frothier, it's called Less Than Kind, which is a quote from Hamlet, and it plays a lot of very conscious gags with Hamlet. But actually, there's a moment right at the end of, I think it's the first act, where Sarah Crowe suddenly makes a decision which is really serious, and everything's been really brittle up to that point. And I suddenly went, oh my God, this is really going to, this is going to take the issue by the horns and really go with it. And it sort of ducks it. But in just that moment, you see, yeah, Rattigan really was a good writer.
Yes, and there's a kind of compassion about him, isn't there? Which I think this whole idea that he should have been out is so wrong. And what Rattigan is so good at is people who've got secrets and who can't say quite what they are.
And it gives those plays texture,
yeah. Doesn't it? Yeah. And that's why I think it's because he's writing within those constraints that he's so good. It's about, you know,
it makes audiences attend to what is not being said, which is much more involving than having everything explained to you, so you just sit back and listen to Jimmy Porter tell you exactly what's on his mind.
Yeah.
And on that note, thanks Charlie, David and Matt.